conference is now being recorded. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Veronica. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the UDLP domain name Lock Working Group call on the 14th of February 2013. On the call today, we have Michele Nalin, Volker Greimann, Hugo de Faller, Matt Schneller, Laurie Anderson, Faisal Shah, and Luke Soto. We have apologies from David Mao, Gabriela Schlack, Julia Lehmann, and Marika Koenigs. From staff, we have Ross Hoffman, Barry Cobb, and myself, Natalie Peregrine. I'd like to remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you, Michele.
Thank you. Good afternoon, ladies, gentlemen, and anybody who doesn't want to categorize themselves as either. As per usual, are there any updates, changes, or whatever to people's conflicts of interest, statements of interest? Any changes? Going once? Going twice? Sold. Next. Okay then, so, as you all know, of course, I have been avoiding you. No, I've actually been busy. I've been traveling, I was away, and I was on holidays, and I'm back. For now. I understand you've made lots of wonderful progress in over the last couple of weeks, and Marika and I had a brief call earlier today, just to see where we were at and just to look at, you know, timelines and everything else. And Alan has joined us. Hello, Alan. So from what I can gather, and correct me if I'm completely wrong, there's a couple of comments on the draft document here that still need to be discussed a little bit. And there's also a document. Oh my God, that all changed. Did somebody move that? Okay. They did. Fine. There's also a document as well with some comments and input from ICANN staff. Now, Luke, you're on the call. Good afternoon, Luke. How are you?
Fine, sir.
Good, good, good to hear. Now, I believe some of your comments, people weren't 100% clear on the rationale behind them. Okay, draft recommendation 5, your comment there about the payment, I think we've already discussed that, so that should be okay. What was the next one? On recommendation 9, anybody have any comments on Luke's comment? That's a horrible sentence. Do we need to add here that this delay has been set up for the defendant to lodge an appeal before a competent court of law, or is that obvious? Does anybody have any thoughts on that? Okay. And also as well, comment 6. Actually, what's comment 6 in relation to Luke? I'm looking at the thing here. I'm a bit confused. We could add that obligation as best practice, if not a mandatory requirement for the unlocking of the domain name. Which obligation? The information for the reg...
Yeah, the obligation from the complainant and winning party to provide its information to implement the decision.
Okay, perfect. Does anybody have any issues or any other comments on that? Nobody. Okay, I'm going to put myself in the queue.
I didn't hear the question. It's Alan.
Hi, Alan. I would welcome you back, but I was the one who was away, so I'll welcome myself back. It's in draft recommendation 9. The wording in the draft is, the complainant is responsible for providing the registrar with the required information regarding implementation. In other words, the information so that the decision can be enacted, basically. And what Luke has suggested is that instead of making this making this more binding, so at the moment it just says quite neutrally that it's their responsibility, but there's no actual obligation on them to do anything. So Luke would like to see that being an obligation. And having removed my chair hat, I would like to support Luke's suggestion, because from our experience, the entire kind of expectation from complainants that we as registrars are meant to mind read and know magically what we're meant to do with these domain names and who is meant to be what and where they're meant to go isn't very helpful. So putting my hand down again. Anybody else have any other thoughts on this?
It's Alan. I have a question. Is the path really complainant to registrar? I thought this has to go through the provider.
Anybody?
Kelly, it's Lori. I'm not sure how other registrars handle it, but we've had a lot of success over the years in dealing with the authorized rep in the case. So generally, that's the authorized rep is the one that we communicate with, obviously, along with the provider. But when it comes time, if the complainant prevails, then, you know, everyone's notified, and then we request an account number from the authorized rep so that we can place the domain name in that account. So ultimately, our communication is with the authorized rep and most often not with the complainant.
Sorry, the authorized rep of?
In the case.
Okay. So it's not the complainant, but it's someone who's identified as the person to deal with,
right,
from the complainant. Okay.
In the complaint, there is always an authorized representative that is identified, and that's the person that's authorized on behalf of the complainant, usually their attorney or law firm, to act on their behalf.
Okay, got it.
Thank you. David,
could be
David plus others. I'm not sure.
Thanks, Michaela. At least it's David for the moment. Just in brief response to that earlier question from Alan, the role of the provider concludes formally, at least, on the notification of the decision. So the panel renders its decision. The provider is then obligated to communicate that decision to the parties and the registrar. The registrar is then obligated to communicate to the parties and to the provider the date for implementation, but the steps involved in that implementation thereafter do not involve the provider in any technical sense. It's between the parties and the registrar from that point.
But for clarification, the provider has told the registrar who the person is that they should deal with and believe is authorized.
Yes, the registrar is on notice of the parties to the dispute, and the provider notifies a decision in which the parties to the dispute are listed. So the registrar knows who the complainant is and who the respondent is, and then it's between the parties, typically a complainant if they're successful, and the registrar to then go about the process of implementing the decision.
Okay. Luke's comments, to answer the original question, Luke's comment sounds reasonable.
Thank you, Alan. Just following up here, I mean, speaking as a registrar, it's not very clear at times who can act as the complainant's representative. I mean, it's not very clear to us anyway. So I think clarity here would be helpful, personally speaking. Okay. Okay, let me rephrase this. Does anybody have any issues with making this responsibility a stronger obligation? Or are we all...
I guess I have a question. If you say they must do it within 10 days or whatever we end up saying, what happens if they don't?
Well, I suppose the question is, okay, I'll explain to you part of the problem at the moment, Alan. At the moment, we, the registrars, are bound to implement a decision. However, if we don't get the information needed to implement the decision and the complainant doesn't understand how domain transfers work, for example, we had one complainant who demanded that we magically move domains to Network Solutions or GoDaddy or somebody, mm-hmm. and refused to actually follow instructions, then we could start getting into trouble with ICANN compliance for not following the UDRP. So my thought on this would be if there's an obligation on the complainant to do something coherent as opposed to not doing anything, then maybe I don't know.
I think you know my answer to that. I'm completely sympathetic with the intent of what you're saying. How do we word that?
Oh, yeah, no, fair enough. Volker, go ahead.
Yes, I just wanted to add to what Michele was saying, that there have been cases where we weren't able to implement the decision for years, where we weren't able to contact anyone on the complainant side after having tried it a couple of times, and in that case, we just wait till they come to us because it's out of our hands.
But
which, I might add, is not practically ideal.
The wording of the policy in that situation should relieve you of the 10 days compliance.
Yes.
This is Matt. I apologize. I'm on the bus, so I'm not sure if I'm you here. One thing I've seen registrars do to sort of discharge that 10 to 15 day window is that they haven't had any word from the prevailing party. I guess the complainant is the only situation that would be relevant. When the complainant prevails, they simply set up an account with an email, the authorized rep or whatever email address for the complainant is there for the proceeding, and say, hey, we haven't heard from you about a specific account number, so we've set this up. No credit card.
Sir, I can't actually hear a word you're saying. You're breaking up.
Yeah, and there's an echo.
Whatever, this is your problem. But we're done.
So, hello? Sorry. We can't hear you.
I'll just send a comment to the email.
Yeah, it's impossible. I can't actually decide. I got the first couple of sentences, and then you kind of disappeared into something weird. There's a couple of comments in the chat. Luke was saying, if providers could add all who is detailed fields in their complaint form, that would help. David Roach Turner, there are possible practicalities that could better be addressed at the level of best practice than necessarily making adjustments, which may come at a certain cost and certainty to the rules themselves. And Volker is, then it's our obligation to figure out which email address belongs to the rep of the complainant. Okay, Volker, you still have a hand up. Go ahead.
That's one of those world-famous vestigial hands, sorry.
Okay, I just thought you might want to say something. Okay, moving on. Last bit here. Draft Recommendation 10, in the case of suspension of proceeding, registrar is required to confirm the complainant, etc., etc., etc. Now, Luke's query here is, if both parties have entered into an agreement, is there really a need for the registrar to be involved and to take responsibility for the execution of the agreement terms? As a reminder, there is no mandatory procedure or standards for such settlements. Registrars could easily render themselves liable by playing broker slash escrow between one of their customers and a third party with whom they have no contractual relationship. Any thoughts on this?
It's Alan. Before we go on to there, does Barry or whoever is taking responsibility for 9 know what to do with it in response to our discussions?
Good question.
Hi, Alan. This is Barry. I'm taking notes in the next version of the draft, and I'll get with Marika to iron out the details of that.
Okay.
But it basically sounds like we need a flag just here for defining what the proper language should be, and then ultimately making the decision as to whether this is truly going to be represented as a best practice versus a change in
okay.
policy.
Thank you. I just wanted to make sure.
Okay. So, any thoughts on Luke's comment on number on recommendation 10? No takers.
Well, we certainly don't want a situation where registrars are obliged to work with someone and may not get paid for it or something like that. I'm not quite sure how to fix it, but the comment sort of seems to have some merit. How often it comes up, and is this a real practical issue or a theoretical one, would be interesting to know.
Okay. Thank you, Alan. Volker.
Well, one thing that we have seen happen quite often from time to time is that the settlement or the suspension happens before there is a settlement. So that might also flow into this at some point, because sometimes it's suspended and then they start working on a suspension on a settlement, which may or may not come out into fruition. So that might also be something that we should look at.
Okay, thanks, Volker. Then David?
Yeah, just this is David. The way that we typically experience these scenarios is that one of the parties, typically the complainant, will come to us as the provider, and they'll say, we would like a period of time, a brief suspension, to engage in settlement discussions with the respondent. We think the matter can be resolved amicably. You know, we'll grant a brief period. If the respondent doesn't object to that, the proceedings are typically then suspended for a defined period, say 7 days, in which the registrar would receive notice and the parties. And then the parties either come back saying the matter's been resolved, you know, the domain name can be transferred pursuant to this agreement which we've reached, and they then attach a copy of that, in which case the proceedings are then resolved on that basis, and we then advise the parties and the registrar that the matter's been discontinued or terminated. And in the event that the attempt at settlement is not successful and the parties come back and tell us that's the case, then we recommence the proceedings via notification to the parties and registrar. The actual practicalities of determining whether or not a settlement has been reached between the parties are generally pretty straightforward. They tell us that a settlement's been reached and they provide a copy of that agreement, or they don't. It's not a procedure that typically involves much time from our perspective as provider, at least.
Okay, thank you. Volker?
One thing that struck me is that the suspension period is not very well defined in the UEOP rules at this time. So as a registrar, I had to figure out for myself what does this suspension really mean for the status of the domain name? Do I keep it locked? Do I unlock it partially? What kind of transfers do I allow? How would I perform that? And that's all policy that we have, in effect, made ourselves. So it would be helpful for many registrars to maybe have an advisory or some statement that tells them how the domain should be treated during the suspension and how what kind of actions may be permissible at what stage.
Okay, thank you. David?
Thanks. This is David again. Just to build a little bit on what Volker just mentioned, what we do at WIPO in cases where there is a suspension is that we issue a notice to the parties and to the registrar, which specifies the relevant period of the suspension, and this is usually a period that's been agreed by the parties. We then provide some guidance to the registrar, not an instruction, of course, but guidance that the domain name remain locked pursuant to any agreement that is reached between the parties as to the transfer of the domain name, and that the domain name should only be unlocked for the purposes of giving effect to any such agreement that would be reached between the parties. In the event that there would be no such agreement reached, then the domain name should be kept on lock status pending the resolution of the dispute in the usual way.
Okay. Any other thoughts on this? So, Barry? You able to make sense of where we're going with this?
It sounds to me, for the most part, it sounds like this really kind of folds into draft recommendation 11, that while Volker says that the suspension period is not really defined, an advisory could be useful, and perhaps that's where that information goes, but... You know, the way I read it as well, it sounds like, David, you know, you guys supply that information within the notice. I guess it would be a question if NAF does pretty much the same thing, and I suspect that they probably do.
Yeah, we're okay. Right. People who have a control of Adobe, could you... Put the other document up there, please. The input from ICANN staff people.
Not entirely sure which document you're meaning. Let me...
Oh, sorry. Bear with me 1 second. There is... The email that Marika sent out yesterday, there's two documents attached to it. One was draft strawman proposal updated 13th February, which is the document that was on screen. And the second one was strawman proposal comments, which is comments from Marika, from ICANN Compliance, and a couple of other things from people, members of the group.
Got it. Give me just a second here.
Perfect. Thank you. David, is that a new hand or an old hand?
I'm sorry, it's a vestigial hand.
ICANN doesn't have elevator music for those periods when we're waiting for things to be uploaded. I'm a big fan of elevator music.
You could sing to us, McKelly.
You don't want me doing that. You really don't. That's just a very perverse and quite screwed up concept. But thank you, Alan. Thank you. Right. Okay. I can't move that at the moment. Barry. Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Barry. Okay. So, a couple of things here. Draft recommendation number from Marika, and then we have some stuff from ICANN Compliance. So, from Marika, draft recommendation number 4. Working group may want to clarify that confirm. Sorry. What confirm is to the UDRP provider. So that's a fair enough question. And actually clarifying exactly what it is. Draft recommendation number 4, would it be helpful to clarify what verification means, what information is requested, is there a standard template that the registrar can expect to receive? If so, would it be helpful to include it or link to it? Any comments on either of these things so far? Okay. Draft recommendation number 4, the UDRP does not mention the verification process. Including a reference definition of the verification process would help clarifying that registrars would need to comply with the verification process if that is the objective of the working group. Any thoughts on any of this? No? Okay. Alan, go ahead.
My hand's up, but it's a slow one. On all of these, I thought we had suggested earlier on that the more we can do to make this an exercise by rote, by you know, specific checklist to a registrar, specifically the registrars that don't do this on a regular basis, the better. So, you know, maybe all of these are in the form of best practices or something, but I think in all these things, what Marika is suggesting is that we provide the level of detail which people who do it every day don't need. So I think all of them are things that we should think about doing. That doesn't mean we need to implement them, but the implementation should provide them.
Thanks, Alan. Speaking as a registrar who doesn't do massive volumes of UDRPs, I would find it incredibly helpful if somewhere on the ICANN website there was an official thing from ICANN, not from a third party, saying this is what you need to do and this is how you were meant to do it, that I could go through and go, right, okay, I have a checklist. Yay, thank you. But it would need to come from ICANN, in my opinion.
Or the providers, because it could conceivably be different for the different ones?
No. I disagree on that, because I have a contract with ICANN. I do not have a contract with the providers.
But there may be variations between the providers of what they expect from some of these words. I don't know for sure. Maybe there aren't. I agree it should come from ICANN, but there may be variations based on provider.
Okay, well, I'll meet you halfway and say, then the providers should give ICANN the text that they need, that they have, but I'm not going to go to the provider's website because ultimately...
Works for me.
I mean, that's just my thoughts on that.
No,
Barry, go ahead.
This is Barry, and I think that's exactly what you guys are discussing is the essence of Recommendation 11 on the straw man, you know, is that ICANN will lead the effort of trying to document this, but we'll collaborate with the providers and registrars and stakeholders as necessary to get the right information up there. And I would imagine that includes finding a home on an ICANN site that contains this information.
Thanks, Barry. I mean, just speaking as a registrar contracted party with ICANN, just from my perspective, when I've had queries about some of these things, ICANN staff always point me at various parts of their website. I've yet to see them ever point me to a third-party website. Just, you know, an FYI more than anything else. Okay, more comments from Marika on Recommendation 5. There should be some gap in time between when the registrar lock is applied and when the registrant is notified of the complaint. Any reason the registrant shouldn't be notified as soon as the lock is applied? Otherwise, the registrant might notice a mysterious lock on the domain name without any apparent reason. Any thoughts on this?
It's Alan. Presumably, the registrar should... you know, do them in close succession, there's still a potential that the registrant may notice something before they be notified. I mean, there are real delays in the world, but it shouldn't be substantive. You know, I suspect we should say that they should notify the registrant, you know, within some amount of time if we don't already say that. But there's still the potential for gaps, and that's life.
Okay. further clarification may be needed. Is the notification 3 days after the provider deems the complaint to be compliant, or is the notification of commencement 3 days after forwarding the complaint, or is the commencement supposed to happen within 3 days after forwarding the complaint? So I think that really could be summarized as, what exactly is the timing? I think. Yeah, what exactly is the timing? I'm trying to summarize it.
I'd have to go back and look at what Recommendations 5 is saying, because she's obviously saying the language there is not clear.
Yeah, I'm trying to... Well, my problem at the moment is I've got about 15 million windows open in Word, so I actually can't find the damn thing either.
My problem, this is my fourth hour of conference calls today, and it's only 10:30. So.
This is Barry. So draft recommendation number 5 states, if deemed compliant, the UDRP provider shall forward the complaint to the registrar and respondent and notify them of the commencement of the administrative proceeding no later than 3 calendar days following receipt of the fees paid by the complainant.
Okay. Thanks, Barry. Any thoughts, anybody? David, go ahead.
Thank you, Michaeli. I just want to clarify on draft recommendation 5 that the date of commencement is the date of notification. So the way that it works is that the provider conducts its compliance check of the complaint as received, and that essentially means going through the rules and ensuring that the complaint is consistent with the various administrative obligations that the complainant needs to meet. Then if they are within a certain period, and this is where the 3 days relates, the provider will then forward a copy of the compliant complaint to the respondent, and that is the point at which the complaint is notified. That is also defined under the rules as the date on which the proceedings formally commence. And what that means is that the respondent then has a period of 20 days to submit any response to that complaint as calculated from the date of commencement. And what I mean by that in shorthand is that the 3 days here, the 3 day period referred to in this recommendation, doesn't really relate, I suppose, in any way to the registrar's involvement in the proceeding. It's a matter that the provider needs to determine in a time frame that they need to adhere to in order for getting the complaint out. But the registrar will receive notice that the complaint goes out on the relevant day, as will the respondent. And that's the date on which the commencement of the proceeding occurs.
Okay, thank you.
It's Alan. I have a question. Recommendation 5 says the provider notifies the registrar and respondent at the same time. I thought we were giving the registrar a jump to get the lock put on before the respondent is notified. Am I just too tired to understand this?
Yes, that's right, Alan. Sorry, this is David. That's correct. That's correct. The way that the sequence typically runs is the complaint is filed with the provider by the complainant. The provider then looks at that complaint to assess whether it's compliant with the rules. But before it does that, it issues to the registrar what's called a registrar verification request. And in that registrar verification request is included a list of questions about, for example, the contact information of the registrant of the domain name, the language of the registration agreement, confirming in a perfunctory way that the UDRP actually applies to the dispute because it's referred to in the relevant registration agreement, and also requests the registrar, among other things, to lock the disputed domain name pending the resolution of the dispute. Once that information is then received back from the registrar, the provider then uses it to complete its compliance review of the complaint. And if there are any inconsistencies between the information that appears in the complaint and the information that's received from the registrar, that's the point at which the provider would typically go back to the complainant and say, there are some inaccuracies in your complaint because the registrar has told us so. Can you please amend the complaint to make it compliant with the rules? And then assuming that those inaccuracies are all corrected and the complaint is otherwise compliant and that payment has been received for the dispute and everything else is in order procedurally, then we proceed to forward that compliant complaint to the respondent and to the registrar. And this is the point at which the proceedings commence. This is the point from which the respondent then has its 20 days to submit any response to that compliant complaint. If the complaint is not deemed compliant by the provider and it's not cured by the complainant, then the proceedings are withdrawn and the provider sends a notice to the parties and to the registrar advising them of that fact. And at that point, typically, the domain name is then unlocked in due course on receipt of that notice.
So it's my lack of sleep not remembering that this is a second notification to the registrar, not the first time the registrar has heard about it.
It's probably the third notice to the registrar.
Whatever.
The registrar probably would... there's lots of opportunities to hear about it. The first one typically is when the complainant files the complaint with the provider at first instance. The second typically is when the provider goes back to the registrar and says, can you please send us this verification information? And then the third is the actual formal commencement of the proceedings.
But it's not the lock order, it's something after that. So I withdraw the question and sorry for taking up the group's time.
Okay, thank you. Great, now I've managed to lose the window. Hold on. Oh, there it is. Okay, then. Right. So one second, scrolling down. Okay, then.
What's the answer to Marika's question, though? The answer, David said, is the commencement. It has commenced when the notice is sent out.
Yeah. I think that's correct, yeah. So I think that's clearer. Sorry, it's just the number of references to compliant and commencement and notification in that one sentence hurt my poor little head.
Okay. So the provider has 3 days to do this, but it commences as soon as they do it.
Yes.
Okay. So that would imply that the wording of the recommendation may be slightly fuzzy if she came up with all those questions which don't apply.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now,
suggestion on point five. The notification, just to clarify that one, the notification is the date on which the provider sends the compliant complaint to the respondent. I'm not sure what the relevance of the 3 days to this statement is.
Well, I thought it was saying that the provider has 3 days to do this. Maybe I'm not reading it correctly.
That's correct. The provider does have 3 days within which to do that. That's right.
Yeah, it's
but the three questions are not. They're not. It's not an either-or situation, is what I'm saying. It is accurate to say the notification occurs or must occur within 3 days. No, sir. See, I'm getting confused. The provider has indeed 3 days following receipt.
And do we want to make this 3 calendar days? I thought we were standardizing on business days.
Well, we need to specify some kind of days, surely.
Yeah.
At present, it's 3 calendar days under the rules.
All right. If you're happy with it, I'm happy with it.
Well, we're certainly happy to change it. three business days is as convenient from the provider's perspective as it is from the registrar's.
Unless, of course, you send them all on Fridays. But anyway, we won't talk about that. Moving swiftly on.
No objection to you, Ed.
Sorry?
No objections. I think it makes absolute sense to switch from calendar days to business days because three calendar days is sometimes impossible to manage for the provider if the registrar has a long holiday, long weekend, and the complaints come in on Friday. Then it's going to be very hard for the provider to make the three-day period based on that alone.
Well, but right now we have a situation where the providers are meeting the three calendar days, but obviously they would prefer three business days. I think that's – is that the summary, David?
Yeah, that's a pretty fair summary, Alan.
Okay.
Just a question from my end here. Do you always meet that? Because even from my experience, I see that there are sometimes situations where we are not able to provide all the answer right away because we have to contact the reseller concerning the language of the agreement, so we are not able to provide all the answers that you're asking for within the three calendar days.
No, that's right. It's not met in every single case, but it's met in, let's say, the significant majority of them.
All right.
Okay, we have about... Oh, Barry, go ahead.
This is Barry. Just out of curiosity, what happens when you don't make it? So it's in the fourth or fifth day. It's defined as a rule within the UDRP, but is there a consequence or any negative occurrence? Nothing happens? Okay, thank you.
It's a good question. The main point to note about the 3 days is that it runs from the point at which the complaint is compliant and it's found to be compliant. And it's not always possible to ascertain that until the relevant response is received from the registrar. So it may be that the period of time exceeds the 3 days. But on the way that paragraph 4A of the rules works at the moment, at least on one reading, until the complaint is deemed to be compliant, that 3-day calendar period doesn't run.
So if you get information from the registrar saying it's going to take a little bit longer to get the detailed of who the real respondent is, you simply do not deem it compliant.
Well, not if we're relying on certain information from the registrar to ascertain that compliant status. So, for example, there's certain information that we're only going to be able to get to the registrar. So, for example, the rules require us to notify a copy of the complaint to any billing contact information which is available for the registrant. And we're not going to be able to obtain that information except from the registrar because, of course, it's not publicly available. So until we have that information or response from the registrar, we're not able to deem the complaint to be compliant. So we may need to wait for a period. This can obviously cause delays if there is a delay in the response which comes back from the registrar for that purpose.
Okay. So you're comfortable with what it says, and the onus is on you to do it. So we don't need to spend any more time on it then.
Sure.
I think that's what I'm hearing.
Yeah.
Okay. I think. And now I'm beginning to understand why nobody... No, hold on a second. So Luke's saying, so in a nutshell, registrars don't need to reply to the provider within 2 business days. Because I'm confused now. So do we need to reply or don't we need to reply?
Sounds like you need to reply, but that reply may say we're working on it.
Oh, okay. All right.
Again, not being a provider or a registrar, that's what it sounds like we're discussing.
Okay.
I'm not sure the policy says that, but that sounds like...
Can I just inject some context here? This is David. I mean, part of the reason we're having this discussion is to manage risks in cases where disputed domain names are not timely locked. So wherever the registrar does not respond confirming that the domain name has been locked and it hasn't been locked, there's a risk that the registrant of the domain name will take that domain name and register it somewhere else or transfer it to another party or whatever the case may be. And that causes huge complexities in UDRP disputes. So part of the reason why I think we're having this discussion is to try and agree on a time that is reasonable and as reasonably tight as it can be to enable the registrars to do what they need to do to ensure that the domain name is locked and confirmed as such. And so obviously the longer the period of this time is, the greater the risks that there is going to be a problem. And I suppose it's also, you know, helpful, I guess, to recall that we're talking about a mechanism, the UDRP, that's intended to be an expedited mechanism. So if we have very lengthy periods of time, you know, under which certain things, you know, are allowed to happen or allowed to drift, let's say, we can risk the effective operation of the policy in a timely fashion. So I think it's good to try and keep ourselves focused on where we can, making the time periods as workable as they need to be, but also as efficient as they can be.
Okay. Volker, then Alan.
I'm not sure. It has been a few days since I last read the UDRP, and I didn't look for this specific topic, but I think the UDRP policy or the rules make some room for the possibility of a registrant change and of a, I think the registrant change, in the case of a registrant change, the new registrant must agree in writing to be bound by the decision, and if on a registrar change, then the new registrar has to lock the domain name. So I'm not quite sure if a late lock is that much of a problem if the domain is transferred, for example. Because the new registrar will be bound at that point.
Alan or David, I'm confused
this,
actually.
This sounds like one of the things we have to, you know, when we get closer to finalization, we have to read over all the recommendations and make sure that they meet the original reason we were convened here, and that is to make sure that the lock is done properly in a timely manner. So,
yeah.
Yes, there may be delays in getting the right information to the provider to allow them to carry it out, but that should not necessarily delay putting the lock on, and we just need to do a sanity check as we're coming closer to the end to make sure that we didn't forget why we're here to begin with. And you know,
okay.
I think at this point, you know, we almost got to get rid of most of the comments and then read it through and make sure we have something consistent and we don't end up contradicting ourselves into different recommendations.
Okay. Thank you, Alan. Right. Ladies, gentlemen, boys, girls, and other classifications, we have about 4 minutes left till the top of the hour. So what I'm, rather than trying to go through the rest of this document, which basically won't happen, what I would suggest we do is as follows. There's some input here from two parties, one from ICANN Compliance, which can be summarized as... Can you please help us? I mean, what they've put it in a more wordy way, but basically what they're saying is that they're not 100% clear on what the term pending means, and would appreciate clarification, and then go on to give us several examples of where the term pending is used in the UDRP, so that's what basically all that's about. So if somebody, now we've had long, very very long discussions about this entire concept of pendency, but I think what they're looking for is a simpler, shorter, clearer definition of what it is. And I'm not too sure exactly what that comment David Roach Turner has made refers to. David, just very briefly, what's your comment refer to?
That was in terms of getting things locked quickly.
No, I'm looking at the document in front of me here on the screen. It says, in part to address the concluding comment from the compliance team regarding breath. Breath of what, sorry? Not too sure what that is. Okay, anyway.
David, sorry, Michael, which part of the text are you referring us to here?
The second page, it says, from David Roach Turner, in part to address the concluding comment from the compliance team regarding breath. If we would go further down the definition route within the WG, perhaps we consider a working definition. Is that your attempt at a definition of pending?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Sorry. Okay, fine. That makes a little bit more sense. So it was the breath term that confused the hell out of me.
The context for that is that there are two relevant events under the UDRP which can affect the issue of pendency, and one is the pendency of a UDRP proceeding, and the other is the pendency of a court proceeding. And the reference to breadth was just simply to ensure that the proposed definition of pendency applied both to the UDRP and also to the issue of a court proceeding that would be commenced. That's all it captures.
Okay, fine. Sorry, it was the term breath confused the hell out of me. But then again, maybe I'm just easily confused. Okay, then. So, right. What I would suggest then is moving forward at the next meeting. Oh, Volker, go ahead, Volker.
Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you there. I think the issue of pendency is of importance, especially because transfers may occur after a complaint has become pending. For example, if we received the notice on Friday, but late on Friday, we have other things to do, not looking at the email or something like that, or it's already past our business hours for a complaint that comes in from NAF. Then over the weekend the domain is transferred accidentally. Then there may be cases where a domain name after the UDRP has become pendent has been transferred, and we might also want to look at that. For example, at a quick lock procedure for that circumstance as well.
I second that suggestion. This is David from Volker.
Okay.
It's Alan. If I remember the discussions we've already had with pending, is that there are not multiple definitions, but there are multiple interpretations of pending, and we need to make sure that they're consistent and implementable. We certainly cannot say if pending is defined as when the complaint is filed, we cannot say the registrar must have locked it by then, as soon as it's pending. That requires time machines. And, ICANN doesn't provide them, last I checked. So, again, we need to make sure that whatever's in the policy defines the terms consistently and only uses one definition. My recollection is in the old PDP rules that we're no longer working on, a PDP was initiated at three distinct different times because we reused the word, and we need to make sure that's not the case here.
Okay, thank you. Okay, guys, we've gone past 1600 hours, my time zone, whatever time it is, wherever you are. So I think, okay, we've gone over. We've got a current draft a report which Marika circulated prior to the meeting last week, I believe it was. And then we have the straw man. So it's just a matter really of updating this based on what we've discussed today. And there's still a couple of areas where, while we may not have a final definitive definition or decision on something, maybe we might just end up with a couple of alternative definitions as suggestions. So if you can follow up, we can all follow up on this via the email list, and I will speak to you all next week. Thank you. Goodbye.
Thank you, Michele.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Veronica, and also the recording.
Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. One moment, please.